Now, since 9/11, the Australian government has introduced 92 laws to combat terrorism, which gives the government a lot of power to control free speech. Earlier this week, GetUp released a report that argues that our national security laws and culture of secrecy are threatening journalists and whistleblowers, and ultimately and fundamentally our democracy. On the line now, I've got Dr. Kieran Hardy, a senior criminology lecturer at Griffith University, to discuss how we can address this democratic deficit. Dr. Hardy, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Toby.
Pleasure. Now, what does Australia's national security apparatus and culture of secrecy currently look like?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, there's 92 laws that we've identified that we would count as counterterrorism laws in Australia. That does include amending legislation because most of our laws do amend some existing legislation, but it also doesn't include broader cybersecurity or other legislation that still could impact on national security. So we feel like that's a fair assessment, and the laws have been introduced in response to different threats of terrorism since 9/11, whether that was 9/11, the London bombings and so on. And obviously recently in response to Islamic State has introduced a lot of powers. So the scope of the laws, the volume of the laws is really significant, and the scope of them in terms of the powers is as well. So there's a whole wide range of powers like control orders, which can amount to virtual house arrest. We have preventative detention orders, which can be up to 2 weeks under state legislation to detain someone, you know, pretty much in total secrecy. So there's quite a lot of extraordinary powers in there too.
I mean, it's the sort of thing when you do kind of put it into perspective and you do go through all 92 of these laws, you really get a sense of this is more significant than you might initially think walking around living your everyday life. How did we get here? Was it just the events of 9/11 that really kick-started us towards this culture of secrecy around the national security apparatus and increased powers such as control orders?
Yeah, I think that's a really good assessment of it, that 9/11 kick-started the lawmaking. Before 9/11, Australia didn't have any counterterrorism laws nationally. So there was no specific crime of terrorism in Australia before 9/11. And so obviously that was a major gap that needed to be filled. And also the United Nations Security Council required that member states address threats of terrorism through preventive measures. So there's no doubt that we needed some terrorism laws. But I suppose what was striking was just the number of them, and that it just kept growing and growing over time. So 9/11, there was a big spike in the number of laws, and then we saw repeated laws enacted in response to homegrown terrorism after the London bombings in 2005, and then more recently in response to Islamic State. But there was a pretty steady stream throughout as well.
I mean, does this type of reactive lawmaking, you know, is this good practice to suddenly see these huge events that are obviously tragedies, that are obviously deeply disconcerting, but to just kind of say, well, we're going to hand over this much power to these types of apparatuses? And I note that one of the key things in your report, for example, is the expanding power of the super ministry that is Home Affairs. Do you think that it's enough that we just reactively say, here's all this power, go nuts protecting us, as opposed to saying, well, look, maybe we should be sunsetting some of this power. Maybe you get this power, but for a certain amount. What are the checks and balances that we need to kind of ensure that this power doesn't, well, continue to grow?
Yeah, really good questions. And so one thing is that a lot of the powers have had sunset clauses attached to them. So that's like an expiry date on legislation. That's precisely like you say, that after a certain number of years, the legislation will lapse unless it's renewed by Parliament. So a number of the powers have had those clauses attached. But what we've seen is that they've just been routinely renewed without really much scrutiny. And partly that's understandable in the sense that there have been evolving and continuing threats of terrorism. But at the same time, a lot of these powers actually haven't been found to be effective. Say earlier in 2012, 2013, before the threat of Islamic State really took off, there were findings by the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor and the COAG Review of Counterterrorism Legislation. And they came out and said, based on everything we've looked at from police and security agencies, so this is not just kind of, you know, law reform and other agencies making submissions on the face of it, but actually, you know, the information behind the scenes. And they came out and said, well, control orders are not effective, not appropriate, and not necessary. and police hadn't used the preventative detention order legislation at that time, and they said we would rather use normal powers of arrest and pre-charge detention and so on, because we can actually ask them questions and lead to criminal conviction. So there were these insights from behind the scenes that led us to believe that the powers aren't always necessary. These strong, being tough on terrorism, it wasn't always necessary. And also we know too that this kind of expanding power and aggressive counterterrorism legislation, being tough on terror, doesn't always work well in the sense that it can make communities feel very targeted. That makes them less likely to cooperate with police and, say, report something of suspicion. And then at the same time, it can undermine those kinds of, in the same way, undermine the kinds of community bonds that are necessary to prevent and respond to terrorism. So countering violent extremism programs are designed to often to improve social cohesion. And if you are undermining that by dawn raids and so on, well, then there's a tension there as well.
Yeah, I feel as though cohesion is undermined when your house is raided by, AFP.
Yeah.
For example, I wouldn't feel very cohesive after that. But look, in terms of this type of lawmaking, what you've just said is basically that, well, these powers aren't really super effective. They don't have the desired outcome. How much of this lawmaking of handing over power to these agencies is about performance, the politics of performance, showing that you're tough on crime, that you're tough on terrorism, when really you can be tough on these extraordinary threats, but without handing over so much power to these organizations?
Yeah, and the Home Affairs Department, like you mentioned, is a good example of that, because over time, most people might not know that Home Affairs Department was actually a Labor proposal back in 2001 or around 9/11, when Kim Beazley, as the opposition leader, suggested that Labor would build a Department of Homeland Security. And Labor kept that policy until around 2007-2008, and they dropped it after an independent review found that building a Department of Homeland Security in Australia wouldn't be effective or necessary and could even undermine security. And then so for all that time, the Liberal government criticised it. And then magically, we turn around in 2017 and Turnbull says this is the best way to move forward with security in Australia. And there have been all these independent reviews and criticisms along the way, including by senior members of the Liberal government. So in that sense, it's pretty difficult to ignore some of the politics involved when Turnbull was in a weak leadership position needing Peter Dutton's support. And then magically we get a department that nobody had recommended along that time, including the agencies themselves. So absolutely, there's a politics to this.
I mean, in terms of Home Affairs, what type of power, can you give our listeners just an example of what type of power does it wield comparative to just a regular ministry? What makes Home Affairs super,
Super ministry, yeah. That wasn't our phrase originally. It was, thrown around the time, either mega department or super ministry. And I suppose it's designed to convey the idea that Home Affairs is a conglomeration of multiple portfolios or policy areas, broadly, Homeland Security related, into the same department. So whereas before we had immigration and border security in one department, responsibility for ASIO, our domestic intelligence agency, was with the Attorney General's Department, and then other police agencies with the Minister for Justice, transport security and infrastructure, and social cohesion and multicultural affairs in the Department of Social Services. All those things then just got put into one mega department or super ministry. And some of those things are more security related, like ASIO and the AFP. Some of them are more social cohesion and social services related. And it's that combination of factors that doesn't necessarily sit so well viewing all those things through a security lens.
Yeah, exactly. So it is just like bringing all these disparate elements together, but also through that one framework of it's all about security, baby. In terms of just how this type of power has been wielded, let's talk about press freedom for a minute. How have we seen press freedom be affected by all of these national security laws? What does this mean if you're a journalist and you're trying to report on issues of national security and the government maybe doesn't want you to?
Yeah, if I were a journalist reporting on national security matters, I'd be pretty hesitant or scared to report on a lot of things because there's a lot of offences throughout these laws that make it an offence to reveal anything about the use of certain powers, whether that's preventative detention orders, the new encryption laws, a range of different things, special intelligence operations that were given to ASIO in 2015 and so on. So there's a range of offences that make an offence just to disclose information, and many times even to receive or just possess it. This is where we get newsrooms being raided to recover classified information, like we saw in 2019 with the raids on the ABC headquarters. And we also see what compounds those risks, powers like metadata, access to metadata, and the encryption laws as well, which risk identifying journalists' confidential sources. So when the metadata laws came out in 2015, we saw journalists increasingly use encrypted messaging or email to get source material. And then the government introduced decryption powers as well, which further risks journalist sources being identified. So, and in the context of a range of prosecutions of whistleblowers going on, Witness K, Rich Boyle and David McBride, the risks are pretty clear, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, if there is anybody listening, there's nothing here at the 2SER newsroom, trust me. There's no one here to begin with, so there can't really be anything. Look, we've really established that the report, it sounds like, identifies a lot of these issues that have accumulated over the past 20 years in lawmaking. But I'm sure that the democracy dossier isn't just about listing all of these problems and then saying, well, that's it. What are some of the recommendations that you and your co-authors have come up with to try and unwind this culture of national security being given prevalence and of secrecy?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, because we didn't want to just kind of criticise and then not come up with some solutions. And I suppose our other approach was to say, well, at this point, it's pretty unrealistic just to say, well, let's disband the Home Affairs Department and just repeal all the laws. And those kinds of suggestions aren't very helpful. So we were to come up with things that, could just pretty, achievable, concrete things that maybe sound quite technical in some respects, but are actually, big wins for something quite small. And that goes down to things like, just put an exemption in a criminal offence for disclosing information that would protect a journalist acting in the public interest. So there would be a defence when you go into the courtroom and say, look, yes, we did disclose this information, but we did so responsibly in the public interest, and that would be a defence to a crime. Like, that doesn't seem too hard to achieve. There are other examples of that throughout the law, and we do see kind of precedent for that in shield laws and so on that protect journalists. Similarly, strengthening whistleblower protections under the Public Interest Disclosure Act of 2013. Generally, there is basically no chance of releasing intelligence information as a whistleblower. That's a trickier area to get it right, but I think there would be a way to craft that law to allow the disclosure of intelligence information if there was no identifying or operational information. All other avenues have been exhausted, and then it was given to a professional news organisation or a member of parliament. So there would be ways of crafting limited exemptions, and these things could be achieved pretty quickly and pretty easily.
I mean, it's not about saying, well, unlock the doors, let everybody know what we're doing in the security services. It's about creating more of a balance than currently exists, because it sounds as though the scales have been fairly heavily tipped towards intelligence gathering and a wide range of powers that sound as though they limit the liberty of the individual a little bit too far.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of those things would just kind of help shift the balance back. Because obviously we do not want, and we're not talking about large-scale leaks like even in the realm of Assange and Snowden and so on. It's these kinds of cases like the Afghan files and similar cases where there's been substantial alleged wrongdoing by Australian, government, soldiers, AFP, whoever it might be. There's something really significant that the Australian people know about, and currently there's not a sufficient release valve for that information to come out. What we're seeing is actually the people who reveal that information are the ones facing prison time when they were trying to act in the best interest of Australian democracy.
Or they face defamation lawsuits potentially, if you think about what's going on with the alleged conduct of Ben Robert Smith. Look, but that's just me off the top of my head. Look, in terms of this report coming through GetUp, what can our listeners potentially do to further engage with this? Would it be going and reading the report? What do you really want to see come from this release?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Reading the report is a starting point. And we've got a whole list of other kind of further reading and references. We use a lot of sources from the media and included them in the reading list if they're interested in those issues. I think any kind of political action, you know, whether that's, you know, sending things to your local member of parliament, sending them a copy of the report, you know, identifying the areas of concern, just kind of having some kind of, you know, weight of support for this, because it comes up from time to time, and then we know in news cycles that something else can happen and then an issue gets forgotten. So whenever anything happens, it's not just about pure national security or counterterrorism matters. Wherever there's kind of secrecy, and that's why we detail a fair bit about FOI laws as well. And we see this repeatedly with the pandemic and so on. So it's not even just about counterterrorism. I would encourage listeners to think about any areas where there seems to be undue secrecy, and try to challenge that and support efforts to do that. So we've seen like Senator Rex Patrick challenging a lot of the classifications of pandemic documents and having, you know, some success in getting those documents out to the community. So if there's anything like a petition or writing to your local member of parliament that could help, then I would definitely encourage that.
Totally. No, that's a very, very true. Freedom of information laws, just as much a part of this as counterterrorism stuff. Kieran, thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.